Public Radio International, this is Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman. A landmark Supreme Court decision put the EPA in charge of regulating greenhouse gases coming out of cars. But state officials complain when it comes to implementing the ruling, the agency's administrator isn't exactly putting the pedal to the metal.
It looks like he is in total stall mode under orders of the president. If that's true, we will sue him.
And climate change refugees from the tiny Pacific island nation of Tuvalu resettle in New Zealand.
People will still look at my car and go, "Hey, where are you from? Which island?" And I'll say, "I'm from Tuvalu." And then they'll say, "And where is that?" What shall I say? "Oh, it has disappeared or submerged on the sea because of global warming."
We revisit the plight of the Tuvaluans. Also, as demand soars, the supply of wind turbines takes a turn for the worse. Take a spin with us this week on Living on Earth.
Support for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation and Stonyfield Farm.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley studios in Somerville, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman, sitting in for Steve Curwood. It's been more than 3 months since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the federal government has the power to regulate global warming gases coming out of cars and trucks. So why isn't Washington doing what the court said? Critics charge the Bush administration is stuck in the slow lane. Living on Earth's Jeff Young reports.
Last November, Massachusetts Attorney General Tom Riley stood on the steps of the Supreme Court to explain why his state had sued the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Riley said global warming gases from autos were harming his state.
In a situation like that where a pollutant is causing harm to public health and public welfare, the EPA is obligated to deal with that. And that's all we're asking. That is all we're asking. Do your jobs. Do your jobs.
In April, the court issued what many called a historic 5-4 decision that the EPA had authority to regulate carbon dioxide coming from tailpipes. The justices essentially agreed with Riley. It was time for the administration to do its job. But what would that job be exactly? In a speech last month, President Bush had an answer.
And when the court says something, then the executive branch of government says, "Okay, you said it, now we'll listen. We'll do what you asked us to do." And so I directed the EPA and the Department of Transportation, Energy, and Agriculture to take the first steps toward regulations that would cut gasoline consumption and greenhouse gases. We're moving forward because the Supreme Court told us to move forward.
It still wasn't clear what action the president had in mind or when it would happen. It fell to EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson to fill in details.
My goal is to have a proposal on the street by the end of the year, with the president's commitment and goal to have that regulation then finalized by end of 2008. That's a very aggressive schedule, particularly for regulation that's very complex.
That doesn't sound very aggressive to officials from states eager to act on global warming pollution. California Senator Barbara Boxer notes that the schedule Johnson describes means there would be no action until just weeks before Bush leaves office.
I find it rather amusing that nothing's really going to happen in his term if we follow that timeline. We're a little worried about that approach because California and many other states are just waiting to act.
California approved a measure to cut tailpipe emissions from new cars and trucks by 30% within a decade, and about a dozen states want to do the same. The Clean Air Act gives California special permission to make its own rules, stricter than federal law, and then other states with air pollution problems can adopt the California standard. But before any state can put those regulations into place, California must get permission, called a waiver, from the EPA. And the state has been waiting nearly 2 years. Boxer thinks the president is simply delaying any decision on the waiver.
We hope not, and I've had many conversations with the administrator of EPA. He's telling me he'll have an answer by the end of the year. We all think the answer ought to come in weeks, not months.
Now Boxer and fellow Democrats from California and Florida are pushing a bill that would force EPA Administrator Johnson to decide on the California waiver by October at the latest. Other members of Congress wonder why EPA isn't also looking at controlling carbon dioxide from sources other than vehicles. Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey called Johnson before the new House Special Committee on Global Warming, setting up this tense exchange.
Just to put a fine point on this, if it's a danger, if CO2 is a danger coming from tailpipes, would it not also be a danger coming from utilities?
From a legal standpoint and under the Clean Air Act, that's one of the important questions that we're reviewing right now.
A rose is a rose. CO2 is CO2, Mr. Johnson. It's a not satisfactory answer.
And Johnson faces still other pressure. California Attorney General Jerry Brown told the Global Warming Committee that he'll take the EPA back to court if California is not allowed to proceed.
It looks like he is in total stall mode under orders of the president. If that's true, we will sue him. We're committed to every legal, political, activist initiative to get this job done. But, of course, they can stall, and ultimately, it's up to you. We need Congress to settle this problem.
And that may be where the Supreme Court's global warming decision ends up having its greatest effect, by prodding lawmakers to act. Sierra Club attorney David Bookbinder, who helped craft the climate change suit against EPA, says the decision is already having an effect on Capitol Hill.
The Supreme Court decision has clearly galvanized Congress into action. Congress is very well aware that unless they act, the administrative agencies, EPA and state agencies, will begin regulating CO2. So does Congress want to become irrelevant, or does it want to step up and create the comprehensive climate legislation?
So even though the Supreme Court's decision hasn't yet brought any real action on global warming, it has made the issue impossible for lawmakers to ignore. Congressional Democrats say they will take up a climate change bill this fall. For Living on Earth, I'm Jeff Young in Washington.
Days, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing. You might want to be an investment banker. That's because the wind turbine business is booming. Demand is so high for wind power, there aren't enough wind turbines to go around. Joining me is Matthew Patsky. He's partner and portfolio manager with Boston-based Winslow Management Company, which manages the Winslow Green Growth Fund, focusing on companies that address environmental issues. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you, Bruce.
Boy, the demand is so big for these things. I was reading the United States went up fourfold since 2000.
Yeah, it's been growing very rapidly. In 2006, we were up 26%, and we're growing a little bit faster this year, up 27%.
Why is that?
The economics of wind are very compelling, and particularly in an environment of rising fossil fuel prices, the economics have only become more compelling as technology improvements have lowered the cost in producing electricity using wind. And obviously, the cost of producing it via fossil fuels has been rising.
But in Europe, it's been big for decades, and it's only recently here.
In Europe, there was a much more forward-thinking federal government initiatives by a lot of the countries in Europe to promote renewable energy. And so you saw, for example, Germany get far ahead of us in terms of use of wind. And basically, broadly in Europe, there's been a lot more use of wind power for producing electricity. And we were slower to pick up on that trend.
Well, the demand is so high now, they don't have enough wind turbines to go around.
You're seeing a couple factors, both the U.S., which is really turning to wind now in a very major way with lots of demand, and, of course, China and India also coming on and as part of their energy demands, picking up wind as one of the resources they're trying to implement. And so you've got such tremendous demand. Everybody was caught without enough supply of wind turbines, and all the way through the manufacturing channel, there's bottlenecks and a need to increase capacity.
We're not talking about the windmills from 20 years ago, which were really kind of small ones.
Right.
The ones now are enormous.
As they've been building them larger and larger, getting more efficient, they've also had all sorts of issues. The old blades were made of fiberglass. You actually, with the new windmill blades, because of the blade size in these wind turbines, you can't even make them out of fiberglass anymore. You need carbon fiber. There's a shortage of carbon fiber, and that's because there's such demand for the carbon fiber for use in applications of wind power.
And you would think that it's such a simple-looking device. You know, it just goes around.
Right.
But it's very complex, a lot of parts.
It is a complicated device and an expensive device, but becoming increasingly economic, and therefore, you know, there's not only just regulatory reasons why there's more and more demand for them, it's because industry is realizing that there's an economic reason to use them. For example, Florida Light and Power now producing almost 20% of their power from wind.
And there are states that require a certain amount of power. I think 20 or 21 states require a certain amount of power be supplied by alternative energies.
Right. Increasingly, states have put in place legislation requiring that there be a move toward a certain portion of their electricity needs coming from renewable. And those renewable standards are indeed helping drive some of this growth, too.
So right now we have this bottleneck on the parts to make these turbines.
Yep.
When does that clear up?
I mean, you have Vestas building new facilities, you have, which is a wind turbine maker, you have Zoltec, which we know well, which is a carbon fiber manufacturer, has been adding capacity in its facilities, particularly in Hungary. So you're really trying to catch up with demand by adding capacity. Now, is there truly ever a catch up in the near term? I can't tell, but I knew that, no, there's more capacity coming on in 2008 with both of those companies.
Wind is bigger than solar.
Wind is bigger than solar because it's more economic. And, of course, geothermal, which is another alternative energy source, is even cheaper. You know, you're going to see some very rapid growth of a lot of different categories of renewable energy over the next decade, and wind is certainly seeing the biggest growth because it has so many applications. It can be put in a lot of different places, and obviously with the wind farms you're seeing are producing a lot of electricity with those larger and larger wind turbines.
But even with all of this growth in the wind industry, it still supplies only a small fraction of the energy that's consumed in the United States, right?
Yeah, in the U.S., 50% of our electricity comes from coal. Less than 3% is coming from wind.
So what would it take for wind power to cover a much greater portion of our energy use?
Well, you're seeing 25% plus growth now. That you're likely going to see acceleration as some of the capacity issues are eased. And, you know, with that, you will see continued growth in the market share of energy that's produced via wind in the U.S. But, you know, you're coming off of such a small base. This could go on for many years. You know, you could see acceleration to 50% and still have that continue for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And we're just sort of beginning to make a dent in fossil fuel use.
Well, Matt Patsky, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bruce. It's my pleasure.
Matthew Patsky is partner and portfolio manager with Boston-based Winslow Management Company.